and begin by paying our respects to Lumpur. I'd like to welcome everybody this afternoon. It's very lovely to see a grand crowd gathered for yet another special occasion. And as everybody is aware, this is the 30th anniversary of Amravati. 30 years ago today, probably at about this time, the first monks from our community came through the gate and were handed the keys. And I think it was Ajahn Viradhamma, Ajahn Sujito, and spent many hours wandering around trying the keys in different buildings, trying to figure out what was here and how it all worked. And then over the next few days, the group of nuns arrived by foot from Chidhurst, and Lumpur Sumedho and the other members of the Sangha arrived to take up residence here. So that was 30 years ago, and so we thought it would be appropriate to mark the occasion by asking Lumpur to offer some recollections and reflections, and also George Sharp, gentleman on the right here, who has played a very pivotal role in the invitation to the Sangha to come to Britain in the first place, and also helping the Sangha to be established here as the former chairman of the English Sangha Trust, which is the charitable organization that looks after all the legal and financial affairs of the community. So George was very much involved in the very earliest days of the Sangha, inviting Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah to come to England to reside at the Hampstead Vihara, and then also helping to support Lumpur Sumedho in getting this ancient tradition from Southeast Asia and India meshed into the English culture of the late 20th and early 21st century. So I'm playing the role of MC somewhat, as you can tell, rather obviously. So what I'd like to do is to ask, first of all, to ask Lumpur to reflect upon what were the reasons, what were the causes that inspired you to, start up Amravati when it was only about 4 years after Chidhurst had opened up. Already you had the idea to launch a place like Amravati. So would you like to let us know what was arising for you, what was on your mind that inspired that courageous, if not audacious, move to open up this whole new place? It opened 5 years, but the thought was in 83. Point.
At Chidhurst, when we moved to Chidhurst and we had permission to develop it as a Buddhist monastery from the council, then we promised to limit the amount of residents and so forth and to the council, so because of the narrow road from what is it, the 272 to Chidhurst House. And by 5 years after moving to Chidhurst, just as the house was becoming livable, we were overflowing. You know, the amount of monks and nuns were increasing very quickly. And I noticed the nuns, some were living in closets, one even lived out in the pig pen and things like that. So the idea of establishing a branch monastery. Also, I thought I'd like to keep Chidhurst as a more secluded forest monastery because of its nature and its situation. I thought it would I didn't want it to become a center. I wanted to keep that kind of forest atmosphere so that the residents would not have a busy place to deal with. And so the idea of coming to Amaravati was to find a place, was before we actually found this particular place, was to look around. And I especially asked north of London, because people, this was before the M25 was completed, and it was a hassle to go through London, and people from London or north of London all complained about how difficult it was to get to Chitthurst. So my idea was find some place north of London. So I asked Barbara and Peter Jackson, who lived in Bedford at the time, now they're living in Wales, to keep their eyes open for suitable property. So that they did, and then they found, and they took me to several other places. Like, at that time, Mrs. Thatcher was closing down institutions right and left, and so there are a lot of empty schools. I looked at even a Borstal and prisons and other things that were really depressing. I remember the Borstal was really depressing-looking place. And then they found this place, which was belonged to Bedford County, but it's actually in Hertfordshire, and it was a school for children with learning difficulties in Bedford who couldn't learn in the ordinary school. So this was actually one of the first institutions to deal with children's learning problems like dyslexia, people that couldn't operate within the ordinary school system. So it had a nice atmosphere, even as a school. It had the staff and the headmaster and all that. And when we met them, it seemed it had a kind of nice, pleasant aromana or ambience. And so immediately when I saw it, you know, Chitthurst House was one of these Victorian houses that was derelict. And it's quite a beautiful house, but to get another kind of stately home or something elegant was not what I wanted. I wanted a place that you didn't have listed buildings and you could pretty much do what you wanted with it. And so this suited that perspective. This place was these wooden huts. It didn't look all that beautiful. It looked like military camp, in fact, but it, you know, it's in a beautiful location. And also, these were not listed buildings. These are not national treasures. And so, and there were about 22, I think, of these huts. And the first time I saw it, I really, because the perception was of this, you're looking up at the sky. You have this, like this huge dome of sky above you, because it's at the top of a hill. And Chitthurst was like the forest, you know, you're there and you're in the forest and you're looking at trees. And then this is just the way I think, the way my mind works. And then Amaravati was like the sky. This was what really impressed me when my first impression was of the sky. So then we got permission to, we finally purchased the property, and this is 30 years later, here we are.
George, do you have any thoughts? Did you have any thoughts at the time about this adventurous move being proposed by your teacher?
Well, I was really taken aback, actually. I mean, we've been in Chitthurst House 4.5, something like that, years. And the house was habitable, and there was a great deal more money to spend, a great deal more work to do. And then Lung Po takes me for a walk and tells me all this. And I'm not short of saying what I think, but I think they said to him, "Why would you want to make your life a misery?" And it seemed to me that Chithurst and the land and the forest was about as ideal as you could get. And in the monasteries I'd been to, with Achen Mahbua and Achen Sha and other monasteries in Thailand, they were all pretty small. And there was still quite a lot of work to do every day. And there's Bung Wai, which was, I thought, a wonderful place to be. You know, it was emergent and everybody was working so hard. And they seemed to actually be quite happy for bhikkhus, really. I mean, they weren't glum and miserable. And so I thought Chithurst was about it. And so to be told that it's not sufficient is a bit startling. But I've got a very simple way of dealing with the problems such as disagreement. I say to myself, what do I know? And so that's the way I went. I thought, okay, we'll do it, whatever it is. And then one morning he rang me and said, Peter Jackson had found somewhere and we should go and see it. And I think we went the next day, actually. And it wasn't a terribly nice day. And and Peter and Barbara were here. And one of the great things was that Peter was not only a surveyor, but also a valuer. And so he was ideal, really, to look around the property. So it comprised of 55,000 square feet of buildings, 37.5 acres of land, and the wood there, that's the 7.5 acres. And in that wood was a sewage system for the whole centre. And we didn't really look around it that long. And I said to Lumpo, "I think this is probably what you want." And he said, "I agree." So, and Peter, of course, because he was so skilled at these things, he could actually put a price on it. And he turned out to be very accurate, actually. He guessed that it was probably worth, this is 1984, remember? 1983, actually. He said it's probably worth £200,000. Now, these days, of course, you know, that'll buy you a rabbit hutch in London. And we didn't have £200,000. Peter did the initial negotiations with the council, and it more or less worked out that they wanted to keep the playing field for some reason, and the rest was for sale. But Peter put together a plan, an offer, which was it was layered offer. If you do this, you get, we offer so much. If you're going to keep the playing field, we offer that, and so on. And he put it together in such a way that the council, who were desperately anxious to get rid of this place, decided to sell the whole thing. And so the next thing was money. So I rang the bank. Now, it was a very nice, wonderful karma, this. The bank manager at Petersfield, who had been with us from the beginning, we hadn't borrowed any money, and throughout that period of 3.5 years, he had been astonished by the way that the place had developed. He was very impressed. And we had good management of the money. But again, he was impressed. But he had previously moved, only months before, to a branch in Bedford. And the thing about Bedford is, it's wealthier than Petersfield, would you believe? And not only that, he tells me later, that he had personal freedom to grant a loan of $8 million without referring to his bosses. And anyway, I gave him a call and I told him about it. And he said, okay, Mr. Sharp, now how much do you want? I said, we want all of it, please. And he said, how are you going to pay it back? And I said, well, as the money comes in, we'll pay it back. and he laughed and said, well, the way it went at Chithurst was so remarkable that I'll go along with that. And so we got the money, and then we have to go and make a firm offer to the council, which then, because this was 50% owned by the health service, and so it had to go to Whitehall to get handed over so it could be available for sale. That took nearly a year. You know, paper moving in Whitehall. And then at that time, when it all went okay, the political group who managed the Bedford Council had changed from, I think, Conservative to Liberal. And I got a message from the council to say that there was a problem, and the councillors were claiming that it had been sold too cheaply, which is another form, a technical form of describing that is gazumping. And so anyway, I rang the... It was actually very amusing, because I rang the chief executive of the council, and he must have known that I was likely to ring. I got straight through, and I said, okay, now, I've got to do this. I've got to put an end to this. So can you do a deal with me on the phone? He said, sorry, Mr. Sharp, can't do that. So I said, well, you're the chief executive. You can do anything you want. And he laughed again and said, well, this is political, I'm afraid. So you've got to speak to the councillor who's in charge of these things. He gave me his telephone number and I called him and said, this is like selling a car, you know? And I said, can you do a deal with me on the phone? He said, I can, because being the chairman, I have that prerogative. So I said, well, 10% more, and that's it. And he said, that will do it, Mr. Sharp. I mean, this is a political thing. He didn't really care about the money. And so that was done. And shortly later, we were able to take over. And I don't envy you guys. It was one of the major reasons the council wanted to sell the property was that the heating system, there was a big, huge boiler here or something, like a boiler or something, and it fed all the heating through pipes under the ground, all of which were not lagged. And so, surprise, surprise, and in 1984, it was costing $40,000 a year to pay the electricity bill for the generator. No wonder they wanted to get rid of it. And And of course that meant that since all the heat was going to heat soil, then the buildings were absolutely, you know, they were like ice boxes in winter, and nothing could be done about it really, except little heating appliances. So now I must tell you that I was not a manager. What I was, I suppose I describe myself as an enabler. So if you want something done, you come and ask George and I'll see if it can be done. But the management was taken over by the Sangha. And they provided the administrative structure from the beginning, which was it was remarkable because they had some extremely clever people and skilled people, and it worked very well.
So, Lumpur, also, along with this being a forest monastery, I think one of the main parts of your vision in founding the place was to be a spiritual center for all different faiths and people of all different dispositions, and that was part of the initiative of having meditation classes, running retreats, was to open the doors to the deathless for everybody. And also, I remember you speaking many times about your choice of the name Amravati as being a counterpoint in that time to all of the dread of nuclear destruction.
I named it after you.
Well, apart from naming it after me, but that was actually your first comment in 1983, I remember. So would you like to speak a little bit more about that, that sense of vision for the broader community?
Just on a personal level, like the moving to live in England from Thailand, I'd had only 10 vasas, 10 pansas in Thailand as a bhikkhu, and that was all like training, and we established the Nanachat Monastery, and it's a forest tradition, so it's called the Thai forest tradition, and so this was my training period, you know, where I learned how to operate as a bhikkhu and also how to develop awareness around the Four Noble Truths. So coming to in Thailand, I was always living in forests, and then this place, especially Amravati, was like I said before, like the impression of sky, and which is like emptiness, and it's quite sometimes I wonder, but this feeling of emptiness occurred while we were still living at Hampstead, right in London, you know, the most unlikely place you think that you'd have that impression. But also at this time in the 80s, there was a lot of paranoia in Europe, especially, and there was the Americans were arming the Brits with cruise missiles, and the Grenham Common, and all these things going on, and anti-war and peace movements were word of the day, and there was this threat of a Third World War, and Ronald Reagan really scared the British when he said he envisioned a Third World War, but it would take place in Britain and Germany. Between and the Soviet Union, and so then the British were really angry, I remember, and felt they were just being like armed by the Americans to be a battlefield, which probably wasn't all that wrong. But anyway, you talk to young people at that time, and they were quite pessimistic about their own lives. Like teenagers or very young people who were brought up in that atmosphere. And there was a lot of talk of death and destruction. everywhere. And so because of this sky emptiness feeling, then I wanted to kind of give it a title which would give the people here a perception of the deathless or emptiness, because they never, we didn't, that wasn't existent as far as I knew in Britain, and everybody was talking about death and destruction and war and a lot of fear and a lot of paranoia generate from those kind of perceptions, but deathless was something that was not in the consciousness. There was not a concept in the consciousness yet. So I deliberately named it Amaravati, which is like a deathless realm. And besides, I found it quite a beautiful word in its own right. So my attempt to plant a word into the minds of the people that come here, that perception of the deathless, that's why I named it Amaravati.
If I can chime in here with an anecdote. So I was living up at Harnam Monastery in 1983 and had been at Chithurst before. So that it was during the summer of 1983 that Lumpur had met with Peter and Barbara Jackson. Peter had made the search from his the files of his estate agency office and had found St. Margaret's School. And so already wheels were turning through that summer and autumn to acquire this property. And I remember coming down from Harnam for the Katina ceremony at Chithurst in October or November of 1983. And we'd heard rumblings about this new center that that Lumpur was planning to open up. And people were obviously, you know, the usual monastic rumor mill was churning away. And there was a thought, I wonder what he'll call it. And many years before, I remembered one of the tea time conversations at Chithurst in the reception room there, and Lumpur had said, as an offhand remark, you know, one day I'm going to found a great Buddhist city and I'll call it Amaravati. And having come across the name in Thailand and visiting Suanmok Monastery, I think you saw the reliefs that had been copied by one of the monks there, and had seen this book of drawings from the British Museum about the Amaravati stupa and the carvings there and the symbolism, which also Ajahn Buddhadasa was very fond of, because the Buddha is never represented in human form in the Amaravati stupa. There's always an empty chair or a pair of footprints or space under the Bodhi tree. And so when we were coming down from Harnam, I thought, oh, I wonder if he's chosen that name Amaravati for this new place. But also along the way, I've been reading this book of called the Splendor of Enlightenment, which is a translation done by Prakanti Palo of the life of the Buddha from the script from the Pali Canon and other commentaries and scriptures. And it begins with the passage, four incalculable periods and 100,000 eons ago, in the city of Amaravati, there lived a Brahmin called Sumetha. And then Sumetha has the initiative to go forth. He hears there is a Buddha, Dipankara, in the world. And he goes forth as a wanderer, and he seeks out the Buddha Dipankara. And then having finally found him during the rainy season, there's a large puddle in the road. And the Brahmin Sumetha throws himself down on the ground to fill up the puddle so the Buddha Dipankara would not have to soil his feet, get his feet wet. And then the Buddha Dipankara says, please get up, Brahmin. Tathagatas do not willingly tread upon living beings. And so then the Brahmin Sumetha got up and said, please, Venerable Sir, you are a Buddha, and I wish in the future to become a Buddha. And I want to know if that will be possible. And then Dipankara says, yes, indeed, in the future, Sumetha, you will be the Buddha Gautama, and you'll be born in the city of Kapilavatthu, and your chief disciples will be Sariputta and Moggallana. So when I was reading this book, and I thought, oh, you know, that, well, even if he does call it Amaravati, you know, he is a Leo, you know, and Leos have got a lot of self-confidence, but that will be a bit cheeky, you know. Assuming that Lumpur would have known that story. So then, down at Chithurst, Ajahn Sujito had made this very beautiful poster for the new place, Amaravati opening in 1984, next year. And so I thought, he did choose that name. So that's interesting. So we were out walking across Iping Common over towards a layperson's house, and we're sort of strolling along, just the two of us. And I said, I realized where you got that name from, Lungpo. And he said, oh, where's that? He said, well, you know, in that the story of the Buddha from the previous life. And he said, what? He said, yeah, you know, when he was the Brahmin Sumedha, and he met the Buddha Dipankara, and you know, the Brahmin Sumedha came from Amaravati. And Lungpo stopped dead in his tracks and went absolutely white, if you remember. Completely blanched and said, I didn't know. So those of you who might have heard or seen that in the stories, that, oh, Sumedha, the Bodhisattva, came from Amaravati, that Lumpur chose the name without knowing the story. And so now he's been given lots of Sumedha rupas of the in Burma. They're very popular. So with this, the Brahmin lying down on the ground with his hands over his head. But also when I came down to Chithurst and I saw the poster, the first thing when I came in the reception room was that you said, I named it after you, Venerable. So little did I suspect that 30 years later I'd be in the driving seat. So maybe if I can ask then, having then arrived here, August of 1984, then the nuns, a part of the initiative behind establishing Amaravati was to provide a bigger place for the nuns. As you said, some of them were in the cupboards under the stairs, some were in the pigsty, like the old woman that lived in the shoe, I think you used to say.
Yeah.
She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. But, there were sort of nuns spilling out of the cupboards, you know, out from the attic and everywhere. So part of the purpose of Amaravati was to give the nuns' community a bigger place to develop, and then also to establish a retreat center. And so from the very start, a quarter of the site was set aside to be a retreat center. And so perhaps, Lumpo, you could talk a little bit about those earliest years of getting established, when it was still a bunch of scout huts that were freezing cold. As George said, I think they ran the heating system for a day, saw how much oil was used up, and then switched it off. Because the heating pipes are 4-inch cast iron pipes. It's about a half mile long heating run. So it was incredibly wasteful. So George was not exaggerating there at all. And so then the first years were sort of heroically rough. So maybe you could talk about that time before, and what was the spirit of the place in those kind of earliest years.
Well, actually, I didn't want to come here myself. Because I really liked Chithurst. It was very beautiful, and it was just becoming livable when I left it. You know, up to that time, we were always living in kind of a construction site and repairing, rebuilding, refurbishing this derelict house. But and then I thought, you know, as the community was growing, I thought maybe I just stop. Chithurst is enough, and we'll just limit it. You know, we'll take so many and then close the doors. And I rather liked that idea, because it would save me from having to get involved in another building, another monastery. But my role model was Lungpo Cha. Who my experience with him was that when I first went to stay with him, it was 1967, and there were only 22 monks there at Wat Bapong, and it was very, you know, it had no electricity and a very basic kind of place. But then over the years, I saw it grow. And the branch monasteries increased every year, and so he was trying to accommodate more and more, give opportunities for more and more monks to ordain and practice meditation. So that was my role model. Lungpo Chao was a very generous kind of monk, and he kind of opened the doors wide and gave opportunities to many, many people. And so that was my model of what I should be doing, and not to be self-centered and think of just a nice, lovely place in West Sussex for myself, and then a select few of people I particularly liked, and then close the door. Even though that was a rather tempting idea, but this wasn't what I knew I was supposed to be doing. So this was a kind of extension of that, and also it was north of London. It's not far from London. It's not far from the Heathrow Airport. It has so many advantages. It was a school, so it had like big halls like this, and kitchens. It had several kitchens and many facilities, like bathroom facilities. And I knew you could accommodate lots of people here at one time, where Chithurst was would never be that. You know, you never could make it into a big center, because it's very limited in the building there, and it's a very highly protected area of England. So this was to me the ideal situation. And I came up here. It was, I've been away from all the worldly problems for many years by that time, and I didn't understand much about money or regulations or any of that business. So I'm quite naive, actually. But it was a period in the 80s where price of oil skyrocketed, when that had the OPEC problems, and oil heating was just so outrageously expensive, and we couldn't afford to run the central heating system here. And none of the buildings were insulated at all. They were just wooden. The place was built by the Canadians in 1939. And there's several of these kind of places. One is in Surrey, and another in Yorkshire, and these were considered summer camps, summer schools. And the idea was to build this to bring children from poor areas of London out into the countryside, so they could look at a cow and a tree and see something natural for a change. And then, of course, the buildings themselves were quite nicely made. They're made out of Canadian cedar. And that's why they've lasted so long, because this is a very fine kind of wood, and it doesn't decay. And so that's, this 1939 when these places were built, and they're still, actually the Canadian cedar part is still very good. So in many ways, it was, and they were buildings that you could tear down. They were nothing that you could change the situation any way you wanted it. But then actually coming to live here, we had to insulate the buildings. And since we couldn't run the central heating system, and it was, of course, August in the summer, and it was good weather. But I knew that the English winter would be quite difficult. And this is on top of a hill and very windy place. So we started insulating the buildings. And by the winter time, it was really dreary. And they had a very, very cold winter that year, and the roads froze, and all the plumbing in all these buildings froze up, and we were just living on little electric fires or these paraffin heaters and things like this, just trying to keep warm, and wearing lots of warm blankets and whatnot. And And during the winter's retreat, I remember they had these lights out here. I think they might still be there with this kind of a sickly kind of sickly yellow light. And when it snowed and it froze, then the whole place was just like a ice skating rink. And then this yellow light at night, you know, and the days are short in the wintertime, is this kind of sickly, kind of jaundiced yellow color on ice. And there was a fireplace here where the shrine is. And so they built a fire for me, and I could sit right up next to a coal fire. The rest are out there freezing. I remember I was walking Jongrom out here, and it was cold, and this yellow jaundiced light on the frozen ice, and I was walking up and down, and I thought, life couldn't be worse than this. And then I had this feeling of joy because I didn't really mind it. You know, I wasn't creating suffering over it. You know, everything was, what I saw was miserable, it's cold, and there was a lot to complain about and a lot to create misery around, but I wasn't doing it. And I felt this kind of joy rise up. I remember that's kind of one of the memorable insights I had here in the first winter. And I realized physical misery is bearable. It isn't really, that isn't the first noble truth. It's the stuff you create around it. And I remember, you know, I think there was a big explosion where the retreat center is, when the ice started melting, and then the what do you call it, where the pipes explode? You know, when they're beginning to thaw. And anyway, in one of the, fortunately, this building where the retreat center wasn't being used, and it shattered the doors of where the Bodhi Hall, yeah, and that was a bit scary. And then to be able to repair these buildings, you had to crawl underneath them. And I remember Ajahn Chandapalo that year, and he's a head monk in Italy now, Sunda Jitarama. I remember coming around, you know, seeing him, his legs sticking out from under the building, trying to repair the pipes, the plumbing, and so forth. But so many things we had to do. We had to insulate and re-roof and the whole thing. But this I found that there was always, we never really got into debt, and people were very supportive, and a lot of from Thailand, funds were sent from Thailand to help, and we had like Tanjakun Panyananda, who as many of you know, but he's passed on many years ago, but he's a very famous monk in Thailand. He was very interested in helping and incredibly generous. So we did have, it wasn't depressing really. And then because you could, when we established the retreat center, that was another big move, because I'd never done anything like that. And Thai forest monks, they don't run retreat centers. And I was into, you know, I was president of the Buddhist Society at the time. I was scattered all over the place. And I was taking on too much, and finally I began to see I had to narrow my duties to establishing a monastery rather than from my idealism, trying to help in every way, all possibilities. So I through learning, this is how you learn. You observe the result of what you're doing, and then you learn from that. Is it worth continuing, or do you have to change? And so this another insight here was, I realized that I have a special ability that lay people don't have. I can establish monasteries. I have been given permission to act as a preceptor, as an upacaya. I could, I could do these things. These were part of my monastic duties, where being president of Buddhist society or these other, active in the interfaith movement and visiting meditation groups all around the country, that was with all good intentions, and I quite liked doing it, but I realized that I couldn't carry on like that, because the important thing was the training of monastics, which is something that lay people couldn't possibly do. So, I that's how you learn. You just through trial and error.
Well, perhaps that I can ask George. You were with Kapila Wado, who established the English Sangha Trust back in 1956. I was in utero at the time.
Oh.
Well, the trust was established in May of 56. I was born in September.
Oh.
So. So you were with Kapila Wado in the 70s, and so you saw things through up until the founding of Amaravati, and in particular, I was intrigued when you were talking with me earlier in the year about how Ajahn Panyu Wado had influenced you into understanding the nature of what a forest monk really wants, and how that informed your contact with Lumpur Sumedho and Lumpur Cha, and how that so I think it would be interesting to hear how you gathered that vision from Ajahn, initially from Kapila Wado and then from Panyu Wado, and your impressions as things were unfolding with Amaravati, how you saw that how things were taking shape as that fitted with your vision that you received from your teachers.
Well, I didn't get that vision from Kapila Wado, who was the founder of the English Sangha Trust in 56. And that was because there was a view that gripped everyone at that time, was that the most important thing is spreading the Dhamma. And everybody was kind of obsessed with it. I mean, we had, like in the case of Kapila Wado Kapila Wado and Ajahn Panyu Wado and the other two, and that didn't last very long, because two of them disrobed fairly promptly shortly afterwards. But what happened was that they went to Thailand, got ordained, and without any training at all, came here to teach. Now, I could find no fault with this, of course, because I had no understanding or learning about Buddhism at the time. And I'd no sooner met Ajahn Kapila Wado than 3 months later he died. And during that time, he taught me how to meditate, which was, I wasn't interested in Buddhism. I just wanted to meditate. But the one thing he did say in the very first talk I went to listen to on a Sunday evening, and I didn't understand this talk. Never heard anything like it. And yet, I'd read a great deal of philosophy in my time. I mean, I could fill a library with the philosophy I read, and religion and so on. And but at the end, he said, any questions? And I said, is the Buddha saying that this thing that I spend all my time trying to protect doesn't exist, this self? And he said, exactly, that's what he said. Now then, in all the philosophy and all the religions that ever encountered in the world, nobody had said that. So it was really remarkable. And that was what actually got me truly interested, because I knew about dukkha, I knew about anicca, but I didn't know about anatta. So there was the triple gem. And I learned how to meditate, then he died. And then on the evening he died, and this is really very important, sat up all night. And just meditated all night. And then there was a point at which I decided that what he tried to do, which is establish the Sangha here in England, he'd failed. And I thought, well, I'm young and strong. Well, I was 40. Oh, yeah, that's very young. And so I thought, I'll do it. I'll make it happen. And that, I didn't realize at the time that that was what in Buddhism is described as aditana, which is really very, very serious intention. I didn't realize that. But it certainly, it actually worked for 25 years. And that's what sort of drove me on. Now, just to get to the point of Ajahn Kapalavada's important role, was that after a few years of all this lay teaching and all the different views and so on, and I became really disenchanted. I thought it was really a bit of a mess, really. And at one point, I actually got the trust deed out and read it, and there's an object clause, and it's not very long, 2 or 3 paragraphs. And it says what the trust should be doing, providing accommodation and all the facilities that was required for the Sangha. Nowhere did it mention spreading the Dhamma. So we had no other duty to fulfill but to serve the Sangha. So I thought the best way of dealing with this is I'll call a meeting. By that time I was a director. Don't think I was the chairman at the time. Called a meeting, and I read out the trust, that object clause. And I said, if anybody can't vote for this, they must resign. And everybody resigned. Except Maurice Walsh. He didn't. And so that was it. There was just, you know. And then I finally had to go around and mop up and write nice letters to people, and then close the place down, really. And we had a guy who looked after the place, who had free accommodation and regular weekly money, so we got looked after, put the heating on in the winter and so on. In the meantime, I thought, I know that Kapalavada still existed, and Banyuado still existed, and he lived in Thailand. So I don't know where I got his address from, but anyway, I wrote to him, told him what I'd done, and he was absolutely delighted. And he used to write to me about once a month, probably often more often than that. And what he did was to tell me what it's like to be a forest monk. He wasn't teaching me. It wasn't Dhamma he was telling me about. It was about the life. And since I'd never seen a monk at that time, this was fascinating. And that correspondence went on for, I don't know, a year or so, during which time I helped with the arrangements, but he decided that he and his teacher, Ajahn Mahbu, had come to London, accompanied by another bhikkhu called Bhikkhu Cherry, Tan Cherry, and ostensibly to meet Mrs. Cherry, his mother. And now, the great Ajahn Mahbu would not have come to London for that reason. He obviously came because Ajahn Panya said, I think it would be good if you would accompany me, and then you can advise on what to do next. So that gave him an opportunity to check out the property, check out me, and generally see what was going on. And during the time he was there, there was amazing. Crowds came from everywhere. And for the first time, you know, serious chunks of money came in. Because formerly, Hampstead people don't give to to the charity. You know, it's something you do when you're at Hampstead. You go to Everyman Theatre, or you go to see the Buddhist monks, or, you know, and then you go to have dinner somewhere. And so suddenly all these devoted people turn up and they leave checks and all kinds of money, and which I was astonished by. And anyway, at the end of it, I said to Ajahn, asked Ajahn Mahbua what he thought I should do now. And he said, very simple, he just said, you should wait for the right monk to come along. And what I didn't know was that at some time around that time, Ajahn Sumedho had met with him in Thailand, and that Ajahn Panyuado had said, if you're in London and you need somebody to look after you, ring this man, me, and he'll look after you. So that was, I didn't know that had happened, but, and then it was simply a question of waiting. And in the meantime, Ajahn Panya was writing me letters. And the place was just closed. Oh, we did get, during Ajahn Mahbua's presence, we got the assistance of Jerry Rollison, the painter of this charity, who is now seriously ill. And so he was a great stalwart at Havestock Hill at that time. I don't know how we'd manage without him. Anyway, so... So then I'd have got a sort of an idea about what monastic life was like, and I decided quite very firmly that this business of the English Sangha Trust spreading the Dhamma was something I would not listen to. And I would make it a point to stop people talking about it. And actually, what I did from then on was to never have committees. And, I mean, even at Chithurst, we didn't have committees. And here, we didn't have committees. And I'd learnt this, really, from Havestock Hill, because what you see there is that the variety of bewilderment and the variety of opinions that become evident with committees are absolutely endless. And it seemed to me that the only way that you proceed when Ajahn Sumedho turned up with the three bhikkhus was that what you need is not a committee, you need somebody wise. And so I decided that in the absence of a committee, I would simply ask Ajahn Sumedho to decide put the decisions required before him, and then he would decide. And I'd do it. So it's really quite simple. I mean, not that everybody liked that, because you meant that... It meant that an awful lot of people with very serious views were excluded from discussing it. And it's true to say that, in a way, it was a kind of benign dictatorship. But the thing is, it worked. And like, for example, at that time, all this work was going on this site, and there was large amounts of money coming in. I mean, I've got sufficient money coming in to actually pay for everything here and also keep Chitters going. So it's not small amounts of money. But the thing was, Lumpur came to me and said, the thing is that the lay people who give all this money, they see nothing for it. It's all going in the ground, all this money. And so we have to do something. So if I remember correctly, Lumpur asked me for £30,000 to create this sala and do something about the kitchen. And that was the next major job. And that was for the purpose of providing the lay people, the visitors who were the supporters, with some evidence that their money was actually having some effect.
Time is moving on. It's about 3:15 now. Lumpur is leaving this evening, so we need to be finished by 4. So perhaps it's a good time to open things up. If anybody has any questions they'd like to ask Lumpur or George about particular aspects of this continuing story, and if you would like to ask anything, then do speak up so everyone can hear your question quite clearly.
I would be very grateful to hear about the temple. How did the temple come into being?
Well, during the time we were here, it was opened in 1999. I remember 4th of July, 1999, and the idea came in the 90s when I was getting confirmation from various people I knew, wealthy people who wanted to sponsor a temple here. Kunwani Lumtum was she was living in London, in Kingston at the time, and she was a very shy person and would come kind of always on the sly, kind of secretly coming in and that, but she had been living in England for many years. Her husband had been had died in an Alitalia plane crash, her eldest daughter and her husband, who established the Thai Farmers Bank in Thailand, which is one of the big banks, and still very big in Thailand. And he was an entrepreneur and a very capable man. Then he suddenly was killed in the plane crash, and Kunwani was devastated. So she brought she had 6 daughters, and one died in the crash, and she brought the other 5 to England and bought home in Kingston, and her daughters went to these girls' school, Priorsfield School for Girls in Sussex or Surrey, somewhere like that,
Godalming.
And anyway, I met her, and she was very interested in supporting a plan of a temple. And of course, the place was not a very inspiring place to look at the time. You know, it had where out there were the cloisters. It was a tarmac kind of parade ground or whatever. Playground, and the buildings were like barracks. It had a feeling of like a kind of Auschwitz or a concentration camp. And even though the place itself, you know, it's in the Chiltern Hills and that, it was, you know, rather dreary in terms of the buildings that existed. So then I was, because of these hints, and nobody said directly, but I got the impression that this was what I could do next. And so I thought I'd better get it done because, you know, Amaravati was like a place without a center. It didn't have a center to it, or it didn't have a heart. There was a retreat center there, the nuns were over there, the bhikkhus over here. This was a kind of all-purpose place where you ate and meditated, and you know, this was, for a while, it was, you know, better than what we'd had before, but it still wasn't, you know, I saw definite ways of improving it. And so I decided to build this temple, and George had a friend, architect,
Tom
Hancock, who was also a Buddhist, and he'd helped build the Peace Pagoda in Battersea Park or in Milton Keynes. And he was very interested, and he had, and the council in Hemel Hempstead agreed that we could build this temple, but we had to take down several buildings, and then we could build the temple. So there was a hall there that doesn't exist anymore. We took it down, and I lived in the back rooms of that hall. It was like a meeting hall with a stage, and behind the stage were dressing rooms, and I lived in these dressing rooms for 9 years. And then another building, which was just
the meditation, where we had the meditation classes.
Yeah, meditation classes in the other one, but it was a pretty grim place. And so those two buildings were removed, and then we were allowed to build this temple. And Tom Hancock, I knew nothing about architecture, but I trusted him. And then he had very English ideas, actually. And the council didn't want an exotic temple. They said, you know, they wanted to kind of blend into the local architecture. And so it wasn't going to be like a Thai temple suddenly appearing in the Chiltern Hills. And so Tom Hancock, we had many plans. He produced many variations on the theme. But the wonderful thing about this place was the location of the temple was perfect in terms of, the shrine faces the east, and so you could actually develop a plan where the temple would be there, and then you connect it to this building, which had been renovated. And so you held this cloister and these entrances, and it worked out quite well, just naturally, without having to make a lot of spectacular changes, because the situation was already set up. And so Tom Hancock had these ideas like these green oak constructions, which is an old European form of building, which had died out in Britain, because Britain being the first industrialized country, that kind of building, pre-industrial revolution, had almost become non-existent in Britain, but still they still used it in Germany, France, and continental countries. And it was being revived in Britain as Britain was becoming more interested in crafts and things like that. So we decided on the green oak structures, and they were built in the traditional way, say, pre-industrial revolution construction. And then Tom had this idea of building it like a barn, so it'd have it wouldn't be a kind of ornate, highly cosmetic effect, but using natural materials. So you have the green oak structures, the beams. They use, what do you call those, pegs rather than, you know.
Mortise and tenon joints, peg joints.
What are they?
Mortise and tenon.
Mortise and tenon, yes. He knows all the English words.
Yeah.
You live in with him, you don't need a dictionary, you just... But anyway, his idea was the bricks were handmade bricks and aren't mass manufactured. And then the green oak and the tiles on the roof also handmade. And so the whole idea was to make it as natural as possible. But then the eight pillars, oak pillars in the center, and the structure that connects them, that's Tom Hancock's genius, because that wasn't a part of the old style, but he was extremely proud of that. You can.
Well, I was I saw that actually being put together, because I was staying with Tom one weekend, and I think he'd lost another wife at that time and lived on his own, and so just me and him. Now, I got up very early that morning, about 5 o'clock, and it's quite a big house, and so I'm wandering through this house, and nobody around, and then I heard the sound, and I thought, he's in his studio, and he must have been working all night, because when I got there, he said, good, come in. And there was a model on the table, and it was made of balsa wood, you know, like where you make little aeroplanes and things, thin balsa wood, and it was all put together with the glue, and I'm sure he'd just been all night putting this together. He said, there, put your hand on it, push down, so, very gently. He said, no, push, and it would not give. And that was the design you see in the temple today, virtually unchanged. And I've never seen anything like it. He'd never seen anything like it. And it had come about because of the references you just mentioned, and also the need for this eight pillars, which would form the outline of the seema. And so there, right in the middle is the seema, and right in the middle of that is the reliquary. And absolutely lovely. And then there was a little, I think it was later that he added the chapel at the back. I thought it was a brilliant piece of work. But then there were modifications, I understand, because you go to Thailand, you discuss it with other people, and then... And I think the dormer windows were added there. And then the slight modification of the roof, you know, to give it that feeling. Because at some point, my friend Frida, I said to her, what do you think of the temple? She said, it looks like a Tesco. Yeah. Now, I take notice of Frida. So anyway, it was a great success, and Tom actually did say at the end that it was the high spot of his career, and he'd had a very, very successful career.
But also the I didn't want it to be just European. So the actual, we're from the northeastern part of Thailand, called Isan, and that's the part of Thailand that borders on Laos, Cambodia. And that is famous, like Ajahn Chah was born there, and Ajahn Mun, and all these Thai forest Ajahns that are now so highly revered are from Ubon, or the northeastern part of Thailand. And it is the poorest part of Thailand. And when I first went there, it was considered, civil servants, Thais working in Bangkok, considered it like being sent to Siberia if he was sent to Ubon. It also had a reputation for producing the wisest monks. And it still does. It still has this kind of reputation. And the kind of symbol for Thailand is Tat Phanom. It's a famous stupa, a pilgrimage place in the Nakhon Phanom province, which is north of Ubon. And it's a very beautiful Lao-type stupa. You know, it has four sides and it's quite graceful. Where like Sri Lankan stupas are domes, and the central Thai have a certain form. But in Laos and in northeast Thailand, they have these kind of four-sided, quite graceful, beautiful symbol in its own right. And this Tat Phanom is the symbol for northeast Thailand. And the original stupa is quite beautiful. It fell over before I came to England. I remember when Thailand was going through a very difficult phase, and we considered it up Mon Khon, a really bad sign. and then they rebuilt it. So today it looks grand. It's really, and my Upachaya, the monk that ordained me in Nong Khai, is from that area, and he retired from his position as the head monk of Nong Khai province and took on the Tat Phanom temple during this time. And so my love for northeast Thailand, for Lumpur Cha, I wanted to have that, a visible sign for that. And so the spire on the stupa is a kind of taken from the Tat Phanom stupa in northeast Thailand. If you notice, it's not English at all. But we got away with it.
and Tom liked it.
Yeah, Tom liked
it. Yeah.
Do we have another question? Bodhipala?
I have no question, but I'd like to make an acknowledgement that when Lumpur mentioned about Khun Wan Lu, that helped me a lot in building this temple, then one of her relatives is here, and I'd like you all to know that he's now a monk. Can you raise your hand?
Any other questions? See many members of the old guard here have their own memories of their time. So. But maybe it's a good opportunity to consider the possibilities for the future. And if you have any reflections, we are expecting you back in. We're expecting you back in November. But if you have any reflections or visions for the next 30 years, durst I ask? But
the Buddha passed away at 80. Exactly the age I am. Eh? But also because of the generosity of so many people for my 80th birthday, I've established this fund sponsoring the Katina here in November from Thailand. We'll come from Thailand. And the funds offered for this will go to Ajahn Amaro for his plan to develop the site, because this was always an idea. We always planned to, because obviously these buildings need replacing, the wooden structures. But after building the temple, I didn't want to build any more buildings. I thought that's my... That's it, you know, that's all I'm going to do. But Ajahn Amaro, without any even hints from me or suggestions, he's taken on the developing the project for improve the conditions here. And so the money donated will we'll go for that fund too, because this has very high expense. It's very expensive. It's a lot of waste, isn't it, for in terms of heating and so forth. So I was just visiting the monastery in California, Bhagiri, where Ajahn Emeril, he started that monastery years ago. And Ajahn Pasuno is there, and they've developed that place. It's a very beautiful place in Mendocino County, north of San Francisco, but it's all steep hills. I call it a vertical monastery, and there's absolutely no flat land is there at all. And so it's a very difficult place to build anything on, but they've developed some beautiful buildings there and built into the hills, and you get these lovely views. It's in Redwood Valley, and it's all very mountainous. So they've developed the kind of green movement, natural type of using sun and various other things, so that their expenses are very minute, aren't they, in running the place. Very inexpensive. The actual building of the buildings is quite expensive. You have to dig through mountains and whatnot, but the earthquake zone, but also its running expenses are very minimal. And I think that's what you have in mind here, isn't it? Yeah, that's the ideal. And Ajahn Pasuno's done a really good job of carrying on when you left.
George, do you have any thoughts for the future, now that you're similarly at the same age as Lumpo and having seen the fruits of your labors taking shape as they have done so far?
Well, no, I don't. I just like to watch, really. I mean, I'm even older than Lumpo. And I don't really think I'm going to live that long. No sharp of this family has ever lived longer than 80. So I'm doing rather well. So, yeah, I'm so impressed by what you're all doing. It's absolutely terrific. And I looked at the plan, and that looks amazing. And if I could write you a check for 30 million, you could have it tomorrow.
You have to win the lottery first.
That's it.
I'll paint a really, really good picture.
So perhaps this is a good note to wind things up on. So Lumpur needs to be leaving the sala at no later than 4 o'clock. So I'm sure there's a large number of you who are dying to say your final goodbyes, because of course this will be goodbye forever. Those of you who've listened to Lumpur's Dhamma Talks on Goodbye Forever, it's included in the five volume collected teachings. There's a certain talk called Goodbye Forever, and where for a period of time that was the way that Lumpur would say farewell to people, but it began to freak people out, or they were from the start they were freaked out because they assumed that he could read the future and that he knew some disaster was going to happen. So after a while, I think it was a few months, he stopped saying it. It's still a very good dharmic reflection, you know, goodbye forever. And so I would encourage people to be able to sort of wind things up and say your farewells. And so Lumpur can leave the hall by 4 o'clock so that he can get ready to depart and catch his plane. And that would be a great kindness to him. So I would like to chant final Jayanto from the community, Lumpur, for your safe travels, and also in recognition of good Master George's efforts over the last 400 years. That the appreciation is very profound and sincere for all the work that both of you have contributed. None of us or none of this would be here without your own great aditana and your great efforts.
Jayando bodhi amole sakyana nandi vadano eva tavam vichayo hoi jayasu jaya mangale appara citta palan ke sise Matavi pokare abiseke sambabodhanang agapa topamotati sunakatang sumangalang supambatang suhutitang sukkanno sumuhu tochasuyetang brahmachari subanda Kinang kaya kamang waja kamang bada kinang bada kinang mano kamang panidite bada kina panda kina nikat wanala bandate bada kine.